Welcome back, everyone. This is Eric Ellison with the Digital Education Podcast. A little bit of a silly name, but I like it because it merges the physical world and the digital world. And I get to talk to friends and colleagues and innovators and leaders and researchers in the world of education, a profession and a place that I love very much. And I get to have a second conversation with Tom Arnett. Tom is the Senior Research Fellow in Education from the Christensen Institute. His work focuses on disruptive innovations in K-12 education and the changing roles of teachers in innovative educational models. And Tom just published with Michael Horn, and you know, it just released some research called The Teacher's Quest for Progress, How School Leaders Can Motivate Instructional Innovation. And Tom, you and I had the privilege of getting a little bit of a preview of this research. But I want to start with the EdNext article that you just wrote called The Secret to Activating Teacher Motivation, where you just simply start with nearly everything in education hinges on teachers. And you talk about standards and you talk about curriculum and you talk about, you know, blended learning or deeper learning. And then you kind of go into this: because children's minds and hearts are complicated, we need teachers' intuition and expertise to figure out the best ways to engage, motivate, and inspire them. And in your research, you make the statement early on that we believe one key reason most school improvement initiatives struggle to gain traction is that they are coercive and that they don't necessarily involve the teacher. So I know that's a big introduction. Thanks for being back. But can you just give me a sense of like what you learned through this research about teachers and about innovation?
Mm-hmm. So let me start off and say, like, why did we think this research was relevant? Well, we spend a lot of time looking at innovative programs and practices in schools around the world. And we've noticed that scaling those programs is often a challenge. There's lots of great points, examples that people can point to, but it's really hard to get those to go system-wide or school district-wide. And so we had this question of, why does that happen? I don't claim to have uncovered all of the answers to that question, but we thought one of the key reasons is that school leaders often don't appreciate the important role of getting teachers really intrinsically motivated about new practices that they're being asked to adopt. So often we hear school leaders talk about things like, they'll use language like, I've got to find my early adopters and figure out who my early adopters are. And then after that, it's, okay, now how do I get buy-in from everyone else? Basically, how do I sell this to everyone else beyond those early adopters? And we thought, you know, that mindset, we think there's something missing in that. We have a theory that comes from outside of education that's really powerful for explaining, why do people adopt the things they adopt? Why do they hire or purchase the products or services or ideas or initiatives that they end up bringing into their lives? And it's called the jobs to be done theory. Now, to be clear, when we're talking about jobs, we're not talking about the jobs that people do. So this isn't the job that the teacher does, the teacher's role as a teacher. This is kind of lingo that we use for talking about circumstances in people's lives where they're looking for something to help them, either help them reach a goal, help them overcome a challenge. And they're looking for things to hire to help them meet that goal, just like you'd hire a contractor to do a remodel on your house, or you'd hire an accountant to help you with your bookkeeping and your taxes. So people in their lives have these circumstances where they're looking to make progress. They're looking to accomplish something. And they're looking around and saying, like, what can I hire to help me to do this? And so we took that lens and said, well, let's go interview teachers and find out, what are they hiring for effectively? What are the jobs that they need fulfilled in their classrooms and their daily practices that lead them to want to pull a new practice or a new resource or a new technology or strategy in and start using it with their students? So that was the motivation for our research, and it uncovered some really counterintuitive insights. One of those being that, a lot of times people think of, going back to that early adopter language, they think of early adopters as just this personality type, that some people are just really tech savvy or really open to new things, and they're your early adopters. And then there's a bunch of other people who don't have that personality type. And then how do you sell it to them? And how do you get them motivated to try something new? And what our research really points to is that early adopters, what makes someone an early adopter is less a function of their personality and more a function of the circumstances they are operating in. And basically anyone can become an early adopter if you are helping them fulfill a job to be done in their lives and in their classrooms. That's the long way of saying our research really dug in on what are these jobs, what are these factors that motivate teachers to pull new practices into their classrooms with a real intrinsic motivation, to really then flip the conversation about adoption. So that it's less about how do we sell teachers on this idea and more about how do we craft this program or this initiative such that teachers will naturally get on board because it helps them do things they're already trying to do.
And so in that crafting, whether it's crafting or cultivating, you know, you give a couple tips in the article, but what did you learn for leaders? You know, really kind of an interesting question for me as a former leader, but then also as a classroom teacher, and then pretty much everywhere in between in the professional world, is what are some of those keys that you saw in this research that really crafted and cultivated that workplace culture that allowed, you know, these educators, these teachers to fulfill, in a sense, these four different jobs that you highlight in the research?
Mm-hmm. So I'd say school leaders are our main audience for this paper, because we really want them to, we want to help them better understand how to meet the jobs of their teachers. And I'd say our recommendations follow along two different strands. One is design your program so that it fulfills a relevant job for your teachers, or alternatively, create the circumstances in your teachers' lives to make a job relevant to them. So they're actively looking to hire somebody to fulfill that job. So in the first strand of make a, you know, identify a relevant job, that's where understanding the jobs that we saw in our interviews really comes into play. So we identified four jobs, and I want to start with the last one. The last job that we identified really confirms our hypothesis that a lot of initiatives are started in the wrong way, because the last job was help me fulfill or help me to not fall behind on my school's initiative. In other words, the school came with a top-down approach, pushed out a new program. The teacher looked at that program and said, this doesn't help me in any way that's relevant to me and intrinsically motivating to me, but I don't really see an opportunity to drag my heels or to object, so I've got to go along with it because I don't want a bad evaluation or I don't want people upset with me. But it's a very compliance-focused mindset of like, I'm just doing this to check the boxes so that no one can come back and say, why aren't you doing your job? And our number one recommendation is like, do everything you can to avoid pushing teachers to that place. Because if you push them to that place, the results aren't going to be great. They're not going about saying, how can I help my students? They're just saying like, how do I not get in trouble with my administrator or with the parents that my administrators got hyped up about this grand thing that we're doing here. So that's number one, is think, you know, you need to really step back and understand the other jobs and then design the program in a way that meets those other jobs. So now let me go into what are these other jobs? Well, the first job we identified was help me lead the way in my school's new program or initiative. So these are teachers who are often in schools that are struggling, and the school already has some kind of program improvement or some kind of grant to do improvements. And these teachers are also often new, or at least in a situation where they're trying to demonstrate, hey, I'm a team player. Like, I contribute to the broader cause of our school. I'm not someone who just wants to go shut the door in my classroom and say, leave me alone while I do my job. And so for these teachers, interestingly, like, they don't generally care so much about the details of the program. In other words, they're not wedded to this has to be project-based learning or it has to be competency-based education. For them, they're just looking at it and saying, number one, does this seem like it will actually help our school? Does the case seem clear that this will help us improve and however we need to improve? And then number two, does this seem like something that is straightforward and simple enough that I can work with my colleagues and get them on board? In other words, they don't want something that's so radical where you're telling them, go pilot this in the corner and no one else is even going to understand what you're doing. They really wanted to be a part of helping something scale to have school-wide impact. And another key to that too is that they wanted a seat at the table. They, you know, they didn't want the school leader to just say, "Here's your instructions, go follow your orders." It was having a place where the school leader came in and said, "Here's our program. Now work, help me to figure out how to roll this out effectively so it'll really make a difference for our school community." So that was job number one. The main insight there being the invitation to be on the leadership coalition of that is valuable to these teachers. And secondly, that the whatever the program is has to be pretty clear and straightforward and you know, have a clear path to this is how we get everyone on board and successful.
So Tom, before you go into jobs two and three, because kind of one and four seem like, you know, kind of like these opposites in many ways. Like, just to give us context to this, are we talking about like an equal distribution of numbers of teachers between these types of jobs, or are there fewer in kind of like job one and more in job four? You know, before you kind of go into even just giving us a little bit on two and three, give us a context of like what you're seeing in the profession as a whole when you go into these schools.
Yeah, well, that's a great and a really important question. I'm glad you paused me there. So first of all, I don't have hard numbers on those jobs. We did interviews with teachers to identify the jobs. Then we did a really informal survey to test and see if the language of the jobs resonated with teachers. But it wasn't a representative sample of like all US teachers. So I don't want to purport that I can give hard numbers. But we did see that job number two, which I'll get to in a second, was by and far the most common or most prevalent job, or the one that teachers, that the most teachers identified with, followed by job number one, and then job number three, and then job number four. Now, but here's where I want to add some important clarifications though. We're trying to be really clear that these jobs are not personas. In other words, the school leader shouldn't think, okay, here's my job one teachers and my job two teachers and my job three and four teachers. Because really, we see teachers having all of these jobs at different points in their careers. Because going back to what I said earlier, jobs are based more on circumstances than on personality traits. So as the teacher's circumstances change, their jobs can change. And so that being said, when we look at these different jobs, the context that you're operating in will shape how common these jobs are within your particular school population. So I think that's an important clarification.
So then, you know, when you then go in and talk about job number two, because that's helpful, because I think one of the things that leaders are automatically going to do is kind of try to define who's in job one and who's, you know, in these different roles as they think about this. And so when you kind of looked and see that job two is the biggest group, help us understand that group as well as group three.
So job two was help me to engage and challenge my students in a way that is manageable. And I want to really emphasize that last piece around manageability, is that these teachers were looking for new practices, new ideas that were straightforward, that they could build on what they were already doing in their classrooms. So, and now to give some context, the circumstances that really defined this job for teachers was that most the teachers that we had interviewed who showed this job felt pretty comfortable and confident in their teaching in general on a day-to-day basis. They felt like they were helping students and they were making a difference. But they knew that in every class, in every year, there are always, you know, the handful of kids who they couldn't quite reach, the few that would sit at the back of the classroom and were hard to engage, or the few that just really struggled to understand the material despite all the teacher's best efforts and best teaching strategies. And so for that reason, these teachers were constantly looking for what are new ideas for engaging these students. So it was a very student-focused mindset, but that manageability piece was really key. In other words, you couldn't tell these teachers, here's this new strategy that means throwing out everything you've ever done before and completely changing the way you teach. To them, that didn't make sense because they'd spent years honing their expertise, developing strategies that worked for them. And so to tell them, throw that all out was like, well, that doesn't make sense. Like, why would I throw out things that work? So it had to build on what they were already doing. The other thing is like the amount of effort had to be reasonable. So So if it was, here's this great new strategy that's going to take months and months of professional development before you'll figure out how to use it, or that's going to take you reading, you know, multiple books before you'll understand it. That didn't fly either, because teachers, you know, I think we all understand teachers are busy. They don't have a lot of time to try new things if it means an inordinate amount of effort just to even get started. Another key for these teachers too is that they really valued having ongoing embedded support. And so, you know, lots of people, this is where we see another common misconception, is lots of school leaders know that professional development is valuable, but many make the mistake of thinking, okay, well, that professional development then means that at the beginning of the school year, when we roll this out, we have a workshop in the days before school starts just to teach people what this thing is and how to do it. Now, that's important, but what really mattered for these teachers was, you know, a week or 2 weeks or a month in, when they started to hit bumps in the road, they needed supports that would help them get through those bumps quickly. If they could get through them quickly, they stayed engaged with hiring these new practices as a way to fulfill job two. But if they hit those road bumps and just got really frustrated and couldn't work through them, then that was often the point where they shifted to job four and they said, this is no longer helping me engage and challenge my students in a manageable way. This is just something I'm doing because I have to, but it's not working for me. So that was job two.
So let me ask you just a clarifying question there. Cause I you know, especially I think in my experience, I see very much of maybe myself in that place, you know, as a teacher. You know, I remember even conversations with my mother, who was a lifelong teacher, you know, where she was getting towards the end of her career and, you know, it was new, you know, new initiative. I think in her last year on the job, you know, she was trying to implement four new initiatives. And, you know, it became that place where it's like, I'm really good at my job. I just want to be able to do it better. And I know I'm kind of coming to the end of my career. And even for me, I think one of the questions that we get to that is that question of manageability, where oftentimes the initiative overload just kind of wipes out any opportunity to really take that initiative or that innovation deeper and have significance. Is that kind of a gist of what you found?
Yeah, we saw that a lot, that like if teachers didn't see the practices as a way to help them improve on what they were doing, they easily did get caught in this sense of initiative overload, and, you know, got tired of all the new things that are constantly coming down the pipe that school leaders are telling them they need to do. I want to highlight too, your question points to an interesting insight also that I think often bucks against conventional wisdom, which is a lot of times when a school leader is rolling out a new program, they can see their older veteran teachers as impediments. That, you know, the old dogs can't learn new tricks type of mindset of, you know, they're not going to change. And what we found, we interviewed plenty of teachers who were 20 years into their career who had adopted some major new initiative, like, you know, doing blended learning or doing project-based learning. And what we found was it wasn't that being old made them not want to change. It was that for them, you have to fulfill a job. And if the job that's relevant to them is job number two, again, it has to be manageable. It has to be additive to what they're doing. But that being said, if the circumstances are right, they will eagerly adopt new practices. So as one example of that, many of the teachers that we interviewed had recently had a change in their teaching assignment. Either they had changed schools, or they'd changed grade levels, or if they were a high school teacher, they started teaching a new course they hadn't taught before. And that circumstance of needing to teach something that they hadn't taught before created the relevance for that job of help me find new things that I can pull into my classroom that are manageable. Actually, I don't want to say it was just for that job. Across all the jobs, having changes like that in their teaching circumstances made the jobs more relevant to them. And so that's where I go back and say, it's not about the personality. It's about the circumstances that make a job relevant or not relevant, or make a certain practice a valuable or not valuable way to fulfill a job.
Well, and I appreciate that clarification too on a little bit of, you know, as I kind of get into the maybe middle and even getting closer towards the back half of my career now, is the appreciation for kind of, you know, being a veteran teacher, but keeping that, that energy, you know, and that new experience to look for more, or to be able to change. But take us through that other smaller group of job three real quick.
Mm-hmm. So job three in some ways was very similar to job two, and in some ways was very different. Job three, we call it, help me reinvent my classroom so I can reach each and every one of my students. So for these teachers, what was similar to job two is that they were very much focused on their classroom. They weren't focused on the school's broader change initiative. It was just, how do I help my students that I'm working with every day? But the big difference between job two and job three was the circumstance of struggle. Job two teachers, like I said, by and large, day in and day out, felt like things were good. They were enjoying teaching. Their students were with them. They were engaged. Job three teachers, it was the opposite. Day in, day out, they were struggling. They felt like, you know, every day I'm struggling with classroom management because kids are bored and kids are lost. I just can't reach all of the varied needs in my classroom. Or we heard teachers say things like, you know, I'm tired of my students just parroting back what they see me do, what they hear me say, and not really understanding on a deeper level the concepts that I'm trying to teach them. Because, you know, the students just aren't engaging with the material and at that deeper level. Or, you know, it may be too a circumstance where the teacher says, yeah, like day in, day out, my classroom's going okay, but I know that recent data that we've gotten from our district shows that a lot of these students are struggling beyond in life beyond our classroom. And that just felt unacceptable to them. And so that circumstance of feeling that like continual struggle and feeling like they were often failing led them to a point where they were saying to themselves, I either need something radically different from what I've been doing, or I'm ready to leave the profession. So I want to give a real quick detour to say one of the interesting things when we look at jobs is that jobs help us see what really competes in a person's life to fulfill that job. And for these teachers, the thing that was competing to fulfill that job was either transferring to a different school that had different practices and different approaches, or leaving the profession altogether. One teacher even told us, he's like, you know, he was within a decade of retirement. And he said, I was looking at quitting my job and becoming a truck driver because I was so fed up with not being able to reach my students. Now, another important thing for these teachers is that, and this is where it gets tricky, is that they wanted the opposite of what a job two or a job one teacher would want. So for these teachers, they didn't want small incremental improvements on what they were doing, because in their minds, those incremental improvements didn't work. They'd had plenty of sessions where the district had said, hey, just adopt this new best practice and things will be better. And they tried it and it hadn't worked because it didn't address the bigger issues in their classroom. And so for them, it was like, don't give me another set of best practices. Give me something that's radically different, that's really going to make a difference in helping me reach my students. Some keys then to helping these teachers fulfill that job, or making a new program relevant as a way to fulfill that job, was that these teachers needed the room and the permission to experiment and to fail, but to fail forward. In other words, if you told them, yeah, go try something radically different, but you've still got to get your test scores up by the next benchmark assessment, and you still got to make, you know, demonstrate that you're keeping with the pacing guide and checking all the boxes on the evaluation rubric, they'd say, that's impossible. I can't keep doing all those things and do things that are different. Something's got to give. So they needed that permission to not have to keep up with all the current expectations, and then to have the space to try new things, experiment. They needed feedback, because it wasn't a place of just like, go let them have free rein and do radical things in their classroom. You know, they needed to see metrics that would tell them, am I making that progress I need or not? But they needed the freedom to try things and learn from what works and doesn't work, and then improve over time.
So let me ask, you know, maybe one question on the leadership side of things, and then one question on the policy side of things, because this is not, I mean, this is great stuff. And I think it's only just the beginning of a much larger conversation on innovation and change in schools, and even just the reform picture of how do we cultivate and craft that. So if I'm a leader and I have, you know, all of these educators in my building, all of these teachers in my building, and I've got people doing these four jobs and, you know, looking for whether it's satisfaction or fulfillment or opportunity to, you know, to kind of fulfill those roles and those positions and that work. How do I, or what would be a suggestion or a couple suggestions that you would give a leader today that says, hey, you know what, here's what all of these teachers or what you can do to draw out more and more of, you know, just the capacity of these people in your schools and in your building.
Mm-hmm. So a couple of things. Number one, recognizing that most of your teachers likely are focused on job two, and that job one and job two line up well. In other words, they're both looking for straightforward improvements, because effectively teachers with job one are looking for things that will be appealing to teachers with job two. So given that that's probably most of your teachers in most schools and most contexts, you know, really think through, how do we make this new stuff logical, incremental improvements on what these teachers are already doing? And how do we support them in a way that they can pick it up quickly and not run into a lot of frustrations or roadblocks? So I'd say that's the first recommendation. That's pretty broadly relevant. The second would be, if you find that there's some teachers that have job three, they need something totally different. They need that space to experiment. So the initiative that works for job one and two likely isn't the same one that's going to work for job three, and that's okay. They need different, you know, different things are going to appeal to these different teachers. Another one would be, if you find that despite your best efforts, there's still a few teachers that fall into that job four category, there is hope. We did interview teachers who started with job four and then with the right support shifted to a job two mindset. So I'll tell the story real quick of one kindergarten teacher who her school had started doing blended learning a few years ago, and she had been away from the profession. She got hired on and she had no idea what blended learning was, because it wasn't at all part of her teaching before she'd gone away to raise her kids for a few years. So she was frustrated, and she initially did blended learning in her class just because she felt like she had to do it because everyone at her school did it. But over time, or I don't want to make it seem like a long time, but within a few months, her district gave her some good professional development that helped her figure out, what does this technology do and how do you use it? And with that support, then she also started to see some early wins and early successes where she was using a particular literacy learning platform with her kindergartners that was really helping them make progress. And with those early successes and with that support, she started to see blended learning as a way to fulfill job two. And so we think that can be, you know, relevant for lots of teachers. If they start in at job four, keep focusing on giving them the support that they need to make the new practices become relevant as a way to fulfill job two. Because job two is likely there for them. It's just that they don't see the new practices as a way to fulfill job two. But job two is relevant. And then the last thing I'd say is timing can be important. Sometimes if you can't appeal to a certain, if you can't help teachers see a new program or a new strategy as a way to fulfill a relevant job, sometimes changing their circumstances helps make new jobs relevant. So like I mentioned, when their teaching assignments change, that made certain jobs more relevant. The other thing that is, if they get new data that helps them see their students and their students' progress in a new light, in a way that doesn't seem punitive. In other words, it's not the school leader saying, I've drummed up a bunch of data to tell you you're a bad teacher, but it's data that they can honestly reflect on and say, yeah, I realize we're missing meeting the needs of our students. That data can often also be a catalyst for making jobs one, two, or three relevant to them.
So let me ask you then this last question, because, you know, you even point out, right, is that this work, the innovative work, doesn't really work unless it's done, you know, by and with the teachers. And where, you know, reform, especially ed reform in my career over the last 20 years has primarily been, you know, incredibly top down, federal government, state governments, even, you know, external, you know, organizations, philanthropies, you know, all of these things. It's been something that's been pushed into our profession. And, you know, you can get into the arguments of the good and the bad of that, but like, what would be your encouragement, suggestion for, you know, policy people as they take a look at this and understand, you know, the value and the importance of the educators within the schools working with the kids.
Well, I tend to think that policy is a pretty blunt instrument. And so with that blunt instrument, you're often not going to get it right as a tool for addressing teachers' jobs. I think the people who are best situated to address those jobs are the people that are closer to the teachers and closer to the students, that can understand their circumstances, understand the challenges they're operating under. So I generally tend to think that, especially when we're talking about innovation, innovation doesn't happen through policy mandates. Rather, the role of policy is, can you create the circumstances that allow innovation to flourish? So for example, giving school leaders the tools to identify the progress or the shortcomings that they're having in terms of meeting their students' needs, that's valuable. But trying to mandate what to do to address those challenges that they uncover, usually not helpful. It takes more of that local context and local understanding. And then from the school leader's perspective, understanding the jobs of their teachers that are going to really lead their teachers to be intrinsically motivated about trying new things.
So Tom, last question as we wrap up, and I really appreciate your time. What's next for this research, or what are the next questions that you're asking with the information that you got from this report?
That's a great question. And I don't have the exact answer, so some of this is going to be stay tuned. But some of the things we've considered is, for a program to work, it's got to meet the jobs of the teachers, but it also has to make sense to school leaders. And so we've thought about doing a follow-up study where we try and understand better what are the jobs of principals and assistant principals who are leading these efforts, so that you can line up with both of those key pieces, because they're both important. If you do one and you don't do the other, you're likely, not going to see good traction and good results. So that may be our next follow-on study, but stay tuned and we'll see what comes next.
Well, Tom, thank you very much. And I look forward to sharing this with a lot of friends. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you as well. It's great talking about this, and I appreciate you seeing the value in it and sharing it with the field.